Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast Air with George Norrie.
Well, if you haven't had a time to get up to Jim Mars and his related websites, do so. They're linked up with coasttocoastam.com. His main website, of course, is Jim Mars, and that's MARRS.com. No, the planet was not named after him. And he's got a related website, which is redgatesecrets.com, and you can link that up with coasttocoastam.com as well. We'll be back with Jim Mars in a moment. We'll continue chatting with him about some things that are extremely alien. And then I have a few questions about the JFK assassination, a case that just doesn't seem to go away. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jim Mars, our guest tonight. Jim, when you wrote Alien Agenda, what really pushed you in that direction? What happened?
Oh, well, that's pretty simple. With the success of my book, Crossfire, which was, of course, on the Kennedy assassination, and was a basis for Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, as I traveled around, I'd ask people, well, what do you think is the next deep, dark, secret government cover-up? And you know what? It was just almost unanimous, from cab drivers to truck drivers to people down here in rural Texas where I live to publishers and people in Park Avenue apartments in New York would say, well, we'd really like to know what's the truth about UFOs. And I got to thinking about it, and I thought, you know, I would too. I've been an avid researcher and follower of UFOs since the 1950s. In fact, I can prove that because there was a very famous, well, maybe it's not so famous, I don't know if everybody remembers it but me, but there was a famous incident that occurred in West Texas back in the 50s, and it happened at Loveland, Texas, which is out near Lubbock, where I went to school at Texas Tech for a while. And this thing landed on the highway, and people, the cars would stall. A few people managed to get out. They went and called the state highway patrol, and the highway patrol would come out there, and their cars would die. And so there was a lot of witnesses to this, and I remember, in fact, not long back, I found a watercolor that I did of this event based on the witnesses' descriptions. And so I did that contemporaneously there based on the news accounts. And that was like in 1954 or 55. So I've been at it for a long time.
You sure have. You know, and I think it might have been that episode that Steven Spielberg used during one of his scenes when he did his Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Do you remember that scene where everybody was parked alongside of a road at night, and these UFOs kept flying by? I mean, it was just a tremendous scene.
Right.
And I think they used some of those episodes, at least maybe the Lubbock Lights case that they talked about.
Right, right. Well, that was another one. By the way, let me correct myself here. I have checked my files here, and the level and landing happened on November the 2nd and 3rd, 1957.
Okay.
Okay, now, the Lubbock Lights, I believe, were even before that, and when I mentioned that I went to school at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, and while I was there, I worked for the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, the newspaper there that's still in publication in Lubbock, And there was one of the photographers there had been one of the photographers, 15, 20 years before that had taken the pictures of the Lubbock lights. These were lights, bright lights in a V-shaped formation that flew over Lubbock, Texas, and then returned the next night. It went on for several nights. Authorities at that time tried to explain this. First they tried to say that it was a plover, which is a type of bird. But then someone pointed out to them that plovers are solitary birds. They don't fly in formation and in flocks. So they backed up and they said, it was flights of ducks, okay, and said the city lights were reflecting off their backsides. That's what everybody was seeing. Of course, I can still recall this photographer for the newspaper who had taken some of the photos, and he just snorted and said, duck butts. Oh, yeah. The people who were there were really not buying the official story.
I can imagine ducks flying, too, holding little flashlights in their feet, right?
Right.
Were you amazed when you started polling people and they said the UFO phenomena is what we want to listen to? We think that's the next major cover-up?
Not really, George, because I had, as my stint as a newspaper reporter, I had talked to people all the time, all over the place, and I knew that the interest was out there. It just came to a head when I made my little informal poll. And while I'm on it, I might also mention that I was already pretty well disposed to be more than open-minded about the Roswell crash, because during my stint as a news reporter in Fort Worth, where, of course, Carswell Air Force Base was located until they shut it down, I had occasion to come across at least three guys, and I don't know how it came up, but it was one of these things where you go off in search of one story and you ended up hearing other things. And these three men both were at Carswell in 1947, and all three said, it was a big deal. They flew all this stuff in. There was tight security. One of them had been an air policeman, and he said that he did not have direct knowledge of alien bodies, but that his roommate and buddy said that he was guarding these bodies. So I'd already heard these stories, and so two of them knew about at least the stories about bodies, alien bodies. The third man did not know anything about bodies, but he said he was there when they brought the crash wreckage through and said that it was just, security was just unbelievably tight. So I already had these stories in the back of my mind. Unfortunately, at the time, I never thought to get these fellows' names or contact information or anything, because it was just something I'd heard while I did other stories.
Did you ever get reports that there might have been smaller ships that came down and maybe a mothership was up there hovering the planet?
Now, what was this, at the time of Roswell?
Or at any time in any of your investigations?
In my book, Alien Agenda, I cover a very, very strange story, which was before Sputnik went into orbit. This was 1954-55. There was suddenly a spate of articles that said apparently that these two gigantic satellites had been found circling the Earth. One was at 600 miles out. One was at 800 miles out. They were circling near the equator. And I have clips from Newsweek and Time and Popular Science. And in fact, the government launched a satellite search program and told everybody get a telescope. Let's all go out and look for these satellites. And they even gave the azimuth reading and the coordinates, said, look in this quadrant of the sky. And there was even some discussion about how that we might use these giant satellites as stepping stones to the moon, because at that time, about all we really had in the way of rockets were the old V-2 rockets that we brought over as war booty from Germany at the end of the war. And so the idea was that we would launch these V-2s and land on one of these satellites and then launch from there, go to the next one, and from there on out of the atmosphere into the moon. And so I actually found the articles mentioning this, and it was written about in some of the publications at the time. And then all of a sudden, They weren't there anymore.
They were gone. Now, this was before Sputnik went up.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and Sputnik went up in 57, I think.
Exactly.
Okay. So, I mean, did these articles say anything about where these satellites might have come from?
Oh, no, of course not. In fact, the whole implication was that they were natural. Somehow they were natural moons that had just not been noticed before or something.
Well, we know that's not the case.
And, what if... This was like in 1953.
Well, and during that period, they really didn't know too much about space at all. What are the possibilities? I mean, this one's a far-fetched question, but I've always thought about this, and I might as well ask you. What are the possibilities that there might have been satellites put in orbit around our planet that, you know, had an ability to keep in the orbit that it needed so it wouldn't crash through the atmosphere, but that these satellites might have been launched from 20, 30,000 years ago from this planet?
Well, of course, now you're getting into an entirely different area, which is, was there a highly technologically advanced civilization in humanity's prehistory? And I'm pretty convinced there was, because all you have to do is look at all of the facts and information, the odd places, the odd statues, the odd artifacts that are now available. And we find that science tends to turn a blind eye to this because they call them anomalies, okay, which is just a fancy word for what the heck is it?
Exactly.
You know, we don't know what this is, and it doesn't fit very well with our little paradigm, with our worldview, the way we have everything all mapped out. And but, you know, we're heading right now for something that I'd really like to talk about, but before we get totally away from the Kennedy assassination, there's something I really want to share with you.
Okay, tell me.
Back last November, as you and your listeners are well aware, there was just this spate of documentaries and retrospectives and stuff, and most of it was pretty pretty lightweight material.
Right.
It was,
the men who killed JFK and all these stories that were out
there. All the stuff that floated around, but I'll tell you, I think the worst one actually was ABC's huge documentary, and of course the keystone there was a computer model that they had done. Well, first off, they just changed everything. For 40 years they've been telling us that Kennedy was shot through the neck, through the strap muscles of his neck. The bullet didn't hit anything, went on strike Connally. This, of course, is the infamous single bullet theory, which is the bedrock of the lone assassin theory. And this time, though, they actually showed the bullet wound in the middle of the back, below the shoulder blades, which is exactly where the autopsy placed it. But, of course, to make it work, they had to have him all hunched over, which in none of the photographs or films do we ever see him doing this.
Yeah, he was sitting up with his back erect and everything else.
Erect. Well, he had a back brace on.
Yeah.
He couldn't have bent too far. And he was waving. So in this computer simulation, they've got him all bent over to the point of looking like a hunchback, and then they've got a red straight line going through his back at the correct entrance point, unlike what they told us for 40 years, coming out through the front portion of his neck and going on down and striking Connally. Connally, they had moved over several inches from where they previously said he was, and then had him turned and contorted, and Peter Jennings was able to say, see, one shot can go through these both men. But what was deceitful about it was the red line comes out of Connally's chest and then just stops in midair. And, of course, what you see there looks reasonable. One shot could have pierced them if they were in these positions. But what they failed to tell you was is that if they had gone on with that red line, it would have had to curve around to the right and strike Connally's wrist from the anterior side, the top side, shatter his wrist bone, and then end up in his left thigh, which would have made this huge question mark curve right there in midair, which, of course, a bullet cannot do. So I thought that was kind of deceitful. But the main thing is this. While they were using a computer model, which we all know the computer can't lie, but what we also know is garbage in, garbage out, right?
Yep.
A computer cannot tell you anything more than what you program into it. Now, at that same time, I was approached by national television in Japan, and they did a big, huge Kennedy assassination. Foundation special, and they too based it on a computer model, except they went to Poland, they went to Scotland Yard, they went all over the world and got computer experts, and you know, guess what they came up with? Five shots from four locations.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, but now here's the clincher. Any computer model would have to be 100% accurate, would have to have 100% accurate topographical information about Dealey Plaza, right? You would have to know the exact elevations, distances, trajectories, all of this stuff. And if anything was wrong, then the whole thing will be thrown out of kilter, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Where did they get that information? Well, all of them, all of these people that have done these computer models, get that basic survey work from the Warren Commission, who in the spring of 1964 hired then Dallas County Surveyor Bob West and his associate Chester Brenneman to go and survey Dealey Plaza based on frames from the Zapruder film. And they would line it all up and they would measure everything and they would get it down to the nth degree. Now here's the problem, George. Years ago, I interviewed both of those men. And both of them, in separate interviews, told me that the Warren Commission altered their figures. Altered the figures. And I can prove this because Chester Brenneman allowed me to make a photocopy of his original plat map. And not only are some of the critical frame numbers changed in the Warren Commission report, but on his original map, they had marked bullet marks on the curb, bullet marks on the sidewalk, a bullet mark in the street, and they both of them said the Warren Commission ordered them to take all that out. So I just think that people need to understand that I don't care who's doing the computer model. For example, if ABC may have even done an honest computer model, but it was based on erroneous information.
Exactly. Information that maybe they thought was right.
Well, they didn't have any other way to know. I mean,
no.
You know. Except the Warren Commission should have known because the surveyors gave them the correct information.
Why would the Warren
changed within the Warren Commission?
Why would they want to change it?
Well, so that they can argue that cockamamie single bullet theory and hence support the whole idea that it was a lone assassin.
And just simply tuck Oswald away in history.
That's right. Well, and of course, the lone nut got killed by another lone nut in the basement of the police station, handcuffed policemen, surrounded by policemen. But there's no conspiracy there, folks. Just one lone nut killed the other lone nut.
You think we'll ever really find out what happened?
Sure, George. We know what happened now. It's just that what you're really asking is
will we ever get it?
Will there ever be a press conference and will somebody get up speaking for the U.S. government and say, okay, here's the real truth about Kennedy? No, I don't expect that, and I don't think we're ever going to get that, because to reveal the truth, to reveal that there was a coup d'etat in this country in 1963 would just cause all kinds of turmoil. I mean, look what happens, for example. I'll give you a modern example. We had a whistleblower that blew the whistle on the FBI crime lab and showed that they had falsified some information and that they had not done some of their testing procedures correctly, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, there was a spate of court cases, and a lot of people demanded appeals, and a lot of people got off because the basic prosecution was flawed.
Right.
Now, if that happened in just that one little case with just some questions and a cloud hanging over the FBI crime lab, think what would happen to all the laws that's been passed by what would be essentially illegal administrations.
Well,
so nobody's ever going to admit to that. But if you want to know the truth is known now. Again, all you have to do is just go, but you're going to have to go study it for yourself. You can't listen to any one person. That includes me. Can't listen to anybody. You have to go and study the whole case out and check it out. And I think, of course, this is impossible, but I think the one thing that would convince any reasonable person is to go and get one of those 7.5 Mannlicher Carcano war Italian war rifles and get you three rounds of ammunition and go out and simply fire the stationary target at 230 feet or whatever it was,
within and a certain.
You can put two shots out of three into that target, and I want to tell you the best marksman in the world really can't do it.
And within just seconds. Within just seconds, Jim. I mean, you wouldn't have time to do it. And I don't think anybody could do that.
Able to do it.
Stick with us. Jim Marr is my guest. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Do you surprise? Couldn't find it in your eyes, but I'm sure it's written all over my face.
The After Dark newsletter is $39.95. Subscribe now and get your free CD of Art Bell and Malachi Martin. Call now, 1-888-727-5505. Coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our guest tonight, Jim Marrs. Hey, beginning March 3rd, Stephen King brings to ABC a world premiere television event. It's called Kingdom Hospital, a place of healing, comfort, terror. And if you have a haunted hospital story, why don't you email it to me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Tell me about it. If it is selected, you will be featured with a special Coast to Coast showcase, and you'll receive a set of Stephen King books, DVDs, plus a pair of Kingdom Hospital scrubs, no kidding, and a book that inspired the series The Journals of Eleanor Drew. Stephen King's Kingdom Hospital, coming Wednesday, March 3rd, to ABC. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Marrs, my guest. Jim, we were talking also about the possibility of our own technology thousands of years ago that might be able to put satellites or rocket ships into space. And I keep looking at our civilization, and let's say it's around 2,000 years old. When did our technology really start to explode? Could you say it was around the 1850s? Is that a pretty accurate guess?
I would have to say yes. Of course, with the scientific age, and in the late 1800s, with the invention of, for example, the phonograph, the telephone, the motion picture camera, things like that. That those were all outstanding breakthroughs. But those were basically a normal progression of work that had been done a long time before. They had really, really primitive and early operating cameras back in almost in the late 1700s. If you talk about an explosion of technology, I think you have to go back to post 1947. Okay?
All right.
Isn't that interesting?
Okay.
In the early 50s and through today, anyone knowledgeable person would have to admit that there has been an incredible explosion of technology. Lasers, fiber optics, computers, you name it, night vision, and so much of that, for instance, Colonel Corso said, was passed along based on technology gained from the crash at Roswell.
Less than 60 years, then, we have tremendous technology where up until about 2,000 years, we have virtually none. How can that be? Yeah.
Exactly. And look at the progress. For example, you know, in the late 1800s, the primary transportation mode was a horse and wagon. And then, just within a few years, they developed a small engine. They put the engine on a wagon, and you had the early, bulky, square-looking cars. And then they decided, well, let's cut down the wind resistance. And by the 30s and 40s, you had it pretty sleek-looking cars. And then in the 1900s, they put a bigger engine on there, added wings, and we finally had flight in 1903 when the Wright brothers took off. And then look where we've come from, those little box kite things with a lawnmower engine on them, to today with the super jets and the test things that we don't even know about, like the Aurora, which isn't supposed to exist, but yet
it's out there.
It's out there. Everybody writes about it. And now, see, you're leading me to something. I want to take you even beyond today, and I'm going to tell you about what we're working on now.
All right.
That is so far ahead of everything. But again, we have a problem, because if they bring this technology out, it's liable to threaten the monopolies and the stability of the economy, the world economy today. And, you know, something that monumental could even lead to war, couldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I'm going to have to back you into this a little bit.
Okay.
Let's go back. Let me tell you the story of David Hudson, who was simply a farmer out in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, I don't want you to get the idea that you're some just little old dirt farmer. This guy was a multimillionaire, okay? And he had a big, huge agri-corporation type business going. But he had a real problem, because he wasn't making a lot of money and he wasn't doing very good with his farming enterprise, because the soil is so baked and so dry that it's really tough to get anything going. You've got to irrigate constantly. So he found in the early 70s that by spraying his soil with a cyanide solution, he tried doing this to break up the soil, but in the process he found out he could obtain traces of metals from the ore, including gold and silver and platinum metals. So he got to thinking, well, I got lots of earth movers and water trucks and road graders, backhoes, all that kind of thing. So why don't I just see if I can get minerals out of the ground? So he checked around, found a place that he could set up his operation, and he started recovering gold and silver. And the way they'd do it is they would take charcoal, and they would from the ground, and they'd strip it with hot cyanide and sodium hydroxide, run it through an electrowinning cell to get the gold out, and then they did what they called a fire assay, which is where you run it through a crucible or a furnace-type thing, and you heat it to a certain degree, and then you would finally leach out this gold and silver, you know. Well, he wasn't getting a lot, but he was getting some. But what he discovered was he was getting little beads of material that baffled attempts at analysis. Something was recovering with the gold and silver that they couldn't explain. And what it turned out to be was an element heretofore unknown to modern science. These were elements composed of a single atom. Now, this monatomic matter is found in virtually everything around us, including the food we eat and the water we drink, in just very minute quantities. And he found that he could retrieve these monatomic elements from noble metals such as gold, silver, copper, cobalt, and the platinum, palladium, rhodium, iridium, osmium, stuff like that. Okay. Now, what he found was is that this monatomic matter acted in a very unusual manner. The nucleus of the atom would stretch and would transform, and it would change the basic composition of the atom. Well, you know, this is pretty wild stuff. And so he took it to an analytical chemist who informed him that what we have here is something that I know is pure rhodium, and yet none of the spectroscopic analyses are saying it's rhodium. It's something else. He said, I've never been taught anything about this. So they took it to Iowa State University, and they couldn't identify what it was. They took it to Harwell Laboratories in Oxfordshire, England, and they couldn't identify it. And he finally found with the old Soviet Academy of Sciences that they had some specialized equipment, and they were able to see that this determined this, that this mysterious white substance was composed entirely of platinum group metals in a form previously unknown to modern science. In other words, this monatomic. In fact, he called this stuff ORME, orbitally rearranged monatomic elements.
And was he the first person on this planet to stumble into this, or was it known before?
The story gets interesting. He was the first person in modern day to come up with this, okay? And in fact, since then, since his discovery, he is now, he filed in 1988, he filed U.S. and worldwide patents on 11 monatomic elements. And since then, you never hear about any of this because this is getting into really basic cutting-edge physics. And so you don't really hear much about this. And then there's a reason for that, too, that I'll get to. But I have a series of scientific papers all dating from the mid to late 80s and up through the 90s with, you know, fancy names like super deformation in palladium 104 and 105, or structure of osmium and palladium isotopes. And all these are from the Physical Review, which is the publication of the American Physical Society. Another paper from the Niels Bohr Institute, quantum size effects in rapidly rotating nuclei. So they are now beginning to mess with the basic building blocks of the atom, okay, which we all know is the basic building blocks of everything. You and I are composed of atoms. The chair you're sitting on is composed of atoms. And so, you know, this was really quite something. But he happened to mention to a rabbi friend of his, have you ever heard about this white powder made from gold? And the rabbis told him, why, yes, but to our knowledge, no one has known how to make it since the destruction of the first temple, Solomon's temple. He said the white powder is the magic, which can be used for white magic or black magic. So Hudson and a bunch of other people, myself included, began to research and find out, well, is there instances in past history that might show us that there was a knowledge of the white powder of gold? And actually, there is. In fact, you can go back to the story of Exodus when Moses led the children of Israel through the wilderness and they didn't have anything to eat. And he came up with a white powder that they all wondered, well, what is this? And in fact, what is it, translated from the ancient Hebrew, is manna. This was the manna of the Old Testament.
And a lot of us thought at the time we were talking about some kind of a wheat or something like that. It was not.
Exactly. Yeah. Because this is digestible. It does make a powdery flour type substance. You can eat it. And you know what it does? It repairs your DNA, apparently. That's what studies are beginning to show. Now, in 1914, I believe it was, you had, 1904, I'm sorry, you had the British archaeologist Sir William Petrie, who discovered on Mount Horeb in the South Sinai Peninsula what he described as an ancient Egyptian temple. And what he found in this temple was a crucible, a furnace, and where they had apparently been working with gold, because nearby there were gold and silver mines.
Sounds like ancient alchemy, huh?
Exactly. That's what the alchemists were after, the philosopher's stone, which is not truly a stone. It's a process, okay? And they were trying to figure out, and of course the whole idea was how to transmute lead into gold, base metals into gold. They knew gold. In fact, think about it, George. All throughout history, everybody has this thing for gold. Well, yeah, gold is kind of a precious metal, but then so is silver, so is, you know, copper, so is others. And yet gold has always held everybody's fascination. And what they find is the monatomic elements can be made from gold more easily than any other thing. Now, what they now call Mount Horeb was also known as the Mount of Moses. And they figured that this is where Moses took the gold and silver and melted down to create the manna, the white powder.
He knew what he was doing, didn't he?
He knew what he was doing, and he had this knowledge. And Petrie, when he discovered this temple, they pulled up the flagstones, and underneath they found secreted away all this white powder. But they didn't know what it was, so they just left it open, and the wind all blew it all away. You know?
Yeah.
Now you go back into further biblical accounts, and you find that when Moses came down off the mountain with his tablets, he found that the children of Israel had taken all their gold, melted it down, and made a golden calf, and were worshiping it.
Exactly.
Okay?
I remember that from the old movie, huh?
That's right. Now, they knew there was something mystical, magical about this gold, but they just weren't sure what it was. I mean, of course, Moses came down, found him worshiping the calf, and threw a fit. He crashed the tablets to the ground, and then, according to Exodus 32, he took the calf they had made and burned it in the fire, and then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. Well, now, wait a minute. If you melt down gold and make somebody drink it, what's going to happen? You're just going to kill them. You can't drink molten gold. But he ground it into powder. He made the white powder from gold, and he made them drink it. And that's when they really began to move as a people, okay? So where did Moses learn all this? Well, it's very clear that he was a ranking Egyptian and that he had studied all of the secrets of the Egyptians, and they had learned all their secrets. This is kind of a generality, but it's true. The Egyptians had learned all their secrets from the biblical patriarch Abraham, who is the patriarch not only of the Jews, but of the Arabs, too. They both claim him as their founding patriarch. And the Bible tells us that Abraham was really not a Jew. He came from Ur of the Chaldees. Well, what's Chaldea? What was Chaldea? That was simply a biblical term meaning Mesopotamia.
Right, right.
And the city of Ur is right over there between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which is now modern-day Iraq. Okay? So, we find that, and by the way, in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the earliest known complete book where they gave all their funerary rites, we find that as the pharaohs made their way to the afterlife, at each step they would stop and say, "What is it?" The exact same translation of manna. I think they were dealing with this monatomic powdered gold.
Lawrence Gardner has done some investigations, as
exactly.
You well know, into this,
yes,
too.
Lawrence has worked on this and has put a lot of this together. Now, what I've tied it into is that with this monatomic powder, they found that it had very, very unusual properties. When you put it into a scale, the weighing pan of a scale, the pan weighed less than it did before you put the powder in it. Huh? That means it's got anti-gravitational properties. And so now we're really looking at something. And then when they heated the powder to a certain degree, it disappeared. Well, now they're really getting interested, and I'm sure that heads were perking up, because who wouldn't like an invisible tank or an invisible plane, okay? But then, George, they found something really extraordinary. They took a little spatula and they stirred around the pan, say, you know, trying to figure out where it went, couldn't feel anything. But then as this material cooled, it became visible again, only it wasn't all stirred up. It was back into the original configuration it was when they first put it in the pan. Which means it didn't just go invisible, it went somewhere.
They even thought it had this levitation property, right?
Exactly. So what we're looking at now is the very real possibility that these single monatomic elements might open the door to limitless free energy, a cure for AIDS, cancer, longevity, faster than light speeds, anti-gravity, and perhaps even interdimensional or time travel. Okay? So it's amazing. And what they are thinking is that, see, the thing that makes us grow old and die is not our bodies. Our bodies, as any scientist or doctor will tell you, regenerates every cell in your body every few days or weeks, right? What happens, though, is that there are these little caps that are on the end of our DNA chain called telomeres. And these caps, after a certain period, tell the DNA chain, quit reproducing the cells.
Yeah, just die down. Get old.
Yeah, just go quiet. And what happens after that is oxidation takes over. The cells in our bodies die, and they're not replaced. And as a result, we have aging and eventually death. Okay? So now they estimate that these monatomic elements, if taken in a proper form and in a proper way, might release the telomeres caps, which means your body would continue to generate new cells, which means your lifespan could be extended by hundreds of years, perhaps even 1,000. And all of a sudden I'm going, bingo, we hear about Methuselah, and we hear about these patriarchs in the Old Testament that lived to be 800 years old, 700 years old, and I used to think, how could that be? But now, if they had the secret of the monatomic gold, that's how it could be. So this is amazing discoveries, okay? But you can see what impact this would have on our current technology and on like that, which brings us now to my real story. Starting in 1999 and continuing in through early 2003, major news sources were reporting major new discoveries by archaeologists in Iraq. It wasn't us, because Saddam Hussein obviously was still mad at us over the first Gulf War.
That's right.
He wasn't letting us in there. Who was he letting in? He was letting in German and French archaeology teams, and they were going in there and making amazing new discoveries. In fact, one thought that they may have actually located the tomb of Gilgamesh. And, of course, if you've ever read the poem, one of the ancient scrolls depicting the story of Gilgamesh, we find that he was after on a search for immortality.
Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back, James. We'll also open up the phone lines. Everyone, you can talk to James about the alien agenda, the JFK assassination, maybe even those ghosts of Roswell when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.